Presumed Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton blasted Donald Trump's business record in Atlantic City today. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. On hand at the event were former Trump employees who offered a different view of his time in the gambling town. WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports.
Clinton spoke outside the now-shuttered Trump Plaza, which closed down alongside three other casinos in 2014. She criticized Trump for reports that he stiffed local contractors who helped him build his casinos. And she mentioned another property formerly owned by her Republican rival, the Trump Taj Mahal.
Donald once called it the eighth wonder of the world.
Last week, about 1,000 service workers walked off the job at the Taj Mahal, asking casino management to restore the health and pension benefits they cut last year.
And now those workers are on strike, and we should all support them in getting a fair deal.
But about a mile up the boardwalk, outside the Taj Mahal, the story was a bit different. Trump no longer owns the place, and workers there say their beef is with current owner Carl Icahn, not the man whose name still adorns the building.
Go, Trump.
Dina Jones has worked at the Taj Mahal as a cocktail server for 22 years.
When he was here, he took care of the employees. He cared about us. We cared about the building. It was a win-win situation. Now with Hillary coming in and trying to blame Trump this, Trump that, he's been out of this building for years.
Bill Brown, a porter at the Taj for 19 years, says Trump was a pretty good owner.
He was all right. He came in every so often. He talked to the workers, said hi, you know, he was a good owner. But now, I mean, now it's a hedge fund. Carl Icahn took it out of bankruptcy. Just give us what we want.
The union, Unite Here Local 54, says no new contract talks are scheduled with the Taj Mahal. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
New Jersey college students can turn to the Higher Education Student Assistance Authority, which runs by far the largest state-based student loan program in the country. But that assistance comes with rigorous terms that have been labeled state-sanctioned loan sharking. Annie Waldman, a reporter covering education at ProPublica, looked into New Jersey's practices in administering its student loan program. Annie, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, that loan sharking descriptive is attributed to bankruptcy attorney Daniel Frischberg. How does he substantiate that claim?
Well, essentially, he has a number of clients which have experienced a lot of difficulties in the hands of this agency. Specifically, the agency is extremely aggressive in suing, and he has been trying to help a lot of students with these lawsuits. And what he has found to be the most helpful is actually helping these students declare bankruptcy in order to get manageable payments.
So that is the primary resort of students who can't make good on the loans? Bankruptcy?
Yeah, so when a student has difficulty and struggles to pay these loans, they essentially will go into default. And what happens once you go into default is that the agency cuts off contact with you and sends you over to the collection firms. And if you're unable to negotiate something that they are okay with, then they will take you to the courts.
And is it the state that is, in a sense, taking the litigant to court?
Exactly. It is the state taking the litigant to court. It's actually more the Higher Education Student Assistance Authority. So it's the agency itself, but they are an arm of the state.
And so why does the state substantiate being so aggressive in its terms?
The way that these loans were originally set up is that they're backed by bonds which are held by bondholders on Wall Street. And so what the agency has said, why they don't have as many consumer protections as federal loans, is that they have to stay true to their fiduciary responsibilities to their bondholders. So it really is the way that these loans are set up and the bonds that back these loans that are set up have effects in how the agency collects on these loans.
Let's get some context. How does New Jersey's program compare with other state programs across the country?
Yeah, so when I was looking into New Jersey, you know, the first thing I noticed is that they were filing so many lawsuits in recent years. So I really wanted to understand how this compares to other states. So what I did was I looked at some, you know, what we consider consumer benefits and looked to see if other states were beginning to have those types of offerings. So if you look at the next largest program, which is in Massachusetts, has a large program, not as large as New Jersey, but it has $1.3 billion in outstanding loans. And they have begun to have consumer benefits that mimic the federal government. For example, they forgive loans if a student dies for the cosigner or if a student is permanently disabled. They also allow cosigners to get off after 48 months of repayment. So, you know, something that's really critical to understand about these loans is that they're really family loans. 90% of New Jersey's loans are cosigned by parents, so it's a lifetime responsibility.
When a student goes about the process of acquiring loans, understandably, the onus is on him or her or their families to read through the terms. Having said that, do these rigorous terms of repayment fall into the very fine print category?
I've spoken with dozens and dozens of families, and the most important thing that they wanted me to understand before getting on the phone with them, before sharing their story, is that they don't want to get rid of their debt. They understand that they signed the dotted line. Their co-signers understand that they also signed the dotted line. This is their responsibility. However, in extenuating circumstances like a murder or, you know, a cancer, you know, something you can't plan for when you're 17 years old, they just expected a little more compassion from their state government.
Well, thanks for shedding light on the topic, and thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Annie Waldman is a reporter covering education at ProPublica. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Philadelphia's center city stands out among urban downtowns as a desirable neighborhood, with residences tucked in among the businesses, shopping, restaurants, and other venues. Other downtowns across Pennsylvania are also seeing a resurgence. Keystone Crossroads' Patrick Doyle looked at how Pittsburgh transformed its central business district from a ghost town after five to a bustling, mixed-use neighborhood.
In 1989, 5-year-old Jessica Fink visited Pittsburgh with her family. Though she grew up less than an hour away, in West Virginia, it was her first time visiting the city.
Whenever we came through the tunnels, I saw the city for the first time, and I just was blown away. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It was like seeing another world.
Fink quickly made up her mind. She wanted this other world to be her world. She told her parents right then that she was going to move to downtown Pittsburgh one day.
My dad kind of glanced in the rearview mirror looking at me, and he laughed, and he's like, honey, nobody lives in downtown. You might work down here, but no one lives down here. It's just offices and, you know, some factory stuff.
Fink's father was right. Between the Second World War and the early 90s, most of the middle and upper classes left for the suburbs. But today, that's changed. Office space in the city's downtown skyscrapers has been turned into apartments, while the Strip District and the Uptown have seen a burst of development. Around 15,000 people now live in greater downtown Pittsburgh. That's the highest it's been in 60 years. So, what happened? It's worth looking west at Denver, a city with a booming greater downtown that now counts 73,000 residents. Ken Schreppel, a professor of urban planning in Denver, says that his city's growth happened thanks to major civic investments in the 1990s.
A lot of cities went through kind of the whole stadium, arena, convention center, museum, library, you know, kind of wave of development, largely focused in the urban core. As part of a broader strategy of allowing kind of the center city to come back and kind of be revitalized.
The idea is a simple one. People started going downtown again because there are actual fun things to do. Pittsburgh has experienced the same change, although a bit more slowly. During the 1990s and 2000s, PNC Park, Heinz Field, and the new convention center were built, and Market Square and the Cultural District were renovated.
What was kind of key to a lot of these investments was urban tourism.
And once people started realizing that you could actually have fun downtown, they started moving there. Since 2010, greater downtown Pittsburgh has grown in population by 20%. Another 3,400 residential units are in the development pipeline. According to Jeremy Waldrop, the president and CEO of the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership, that population growth has caused a shift.
That has fundamentally changed the way the city functions. People are out on the streets later. So you have folks walking dogs at 11 p.m. You see strollers kind of walking through downtown. And 10 years ago, you'd be hard-pressed to find those.
Jessica Fink kept her promise to her parents. She moved downtown in 2013 and loved how walkable it was. But after a little while, she started noticing that the area lacked key amenities she was used to. There were plenty of restaurants, but but there weren't many retail outlets. Green space was at a minimum, and there were few options for families.
If they could make it more family-friendly, you know, more like maybe like a little park with like a little playground.
But the biggest complaint about downtown Pittsburgh is a lack of a grocery store. This is something that Jeremy Waldrop, with the Downtown Partnership, hears constantly.
Folks still want a Giant Eagle, a Whole Foods, a Trader Joe's. We hear from them a lot.
According to Waldrop, grocers and retailers are interested in downtown Pittsburgh, but they just need to find the right spaces. Once again, Denver can serve as a promising example. In 2015, after years of demand, that city's first downtown grocery store finally opened. And now, just a block away from there, a second is under construction. So, Pittsburgh grocery stores, here's an official notice. You're wanted downtown. Patrick Doyle, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. Still ahead this evening, some lawmakers want to close a loophole in the rules regarding importing endangered species.
That tiny exemption is being interpreted in such a broad way that any sort of game hunter is able to get this exemption, provided they make a donation.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. The recent shooting of a zoo gorilla in Cincinnati focused attention on endangered species and the permitting scheme that allows them to, for example, come into the United States. And that scheme is of interest to Pennsylvania 13th District Democratic Congressman Brendan Boyle. Congressman Boyle, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Great to be on.
This scheme has been described as pay-to-play. Would you explain?
Yeah, and frankly, that's my description, and it's an accurate one, unfortunately. You know, we've had the Endangered Species Act for over 40 years, and it is intended to protect very rare, unique animal life.
Including gorillas.
Including gorillas, including Cecil the lion, who was killed a year ago. The only problem is that the way it's been interpreted for years now by the Fish and Wildlife Service is that any game hunter or anyone with some money, as low as $1,000, can tell them they're going to make a donation and get an exemption where basically they can get around and violate the express intent of the Endangered Species Act. It's really outrageous.
To whom is the donation made?
Well, that's another part of the outrage. So first, there isn't anything on paper. They just promise they'll make a donation. In a number of cases, no money is donated at all. And in those cases where there have been donations, and we've documented over 1,000 of them in the last 5 years, they can actually be to nonprofits that have nothing to do with conservation or animal preservation.
Have you had the opportunity to speak with Fish and Wildlife Service Director Daniel Ash about the matter?
So I sent a very detailed 5-page letter to him a couple weeks ago, detailing what we found in terms of the pay-to-play scheme, showing how we believe that this is clearly in violation of the Endangered Species Act, and specifically laying out 7 key areas of concern. We have not yet heard back at all from the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Congressman Boyle, we did raise this issue with the chief operating officer at the Philadelphia Zoo, Dr. Andrew Baker. Let's give a listen to his assessment.
I will say that our own experience has been that U.S. Fish and Wildlife has looked very closely at our application. We had to provide additional information, even in cases where I felt like we had demonstrated a tremendous amount of engagement with species.
So it sounds like there's due diligence on the part of the zoo, but you're saying it's the Fish and Wildlife Service that's falling down on this.
Yeah, and I don't doubt that the Philadelphia Zoo and other responsible actors are acting in a proper way. That's not the concern or problem. The problem is the numerous unvetted, both domestic and foreign charities that are receiving this money, and as I mentioned, have not been vetted at all. Not to mention the fact that this is even happening in the first place. You know, the reason why there was this one narrow exemption carved into the Endangered Species Act was to attempt to improve the overall animal life, if there was a humanitarian reason, if there was a scientific reason, that tiny, narrow exemption is being interpreted in such a broad way that any sort of game hunter is able to get this exemption, provided they make a donation in order to get it.
If you find ultimately that Daniel Ash, director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's answers to your questions are not satisfactory, what steps could be taken next?
Well, we've had discussions both internally here in Congress and with the administration on what the next steps would be. That includes a full congressional report. Keep in mind, a number of the things that I've talked about aren't just unfounded allegations or things that we found. The Congressional Research Service has documented exactly what I've been talking about. So this is pretty well documented, and I think taking the next step, having a committee hearing with subpoena power, raising this at a higher level with the administration, those are just a number of the tools that are at our disposal to make sure in the end of the day we get this stopped.
Congressman Boyle, thanks so much for taking time to explain the issue to our audience.
All right, thank you.
Pennsylvania Democratic Congressman Brendan Boyle. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Election years are interesting times for language use and, some might say, abuse. Though it's not only politicians who play around with words to avoid saying certain things, like positive comments of an opponent or backpedaling the negative in their own party or background. Commentator David Woods is calling for an end to euphemisms.
Heck on wheels, proclaims a recent newspaper headline for a roller derby. Heck? I mean, what's next? Heck's angels? War is heck? Heck hath no fury? One wonders how modern society, with its bandying about of the F-word and its graphic depiction of sex in theater and film, could be so squeamish about language. By definition, euphemism means substituting a favorable expression for a more accurate or possibly offensive one. Literally, it means fair of speech. Thus, there are no longer any old people, only senior citizens. The poor have become the underprivileged, drug addicts are the chemically dependent, and people do not die, they pass away or go to their reward. And nobody's fired. They're downsized or let go. How happy Thomas Bowdler would have been with all of this. After years spent in medicine, travel, and philanthropy, and some study of the education of children, Bowdler set out in 1818 to purify the works of Shakespeare, striking from them those words and expressions that cannot with propriety be read aloud in the family. The word Bowdlerize was first used in print in 1836 and became a term of abuse. The Victorian age in which he lived was the heyday of euphemism, a time when pregnant women were described as being in an interesting condition. Trousers were referred to as nether garments, and it was even suggested, perhaps jocularly, that piano legs be covered up lest viewing them might give rise to lascivious thoughts. Theodore Bernstein, in his book The Careful Writer, notes that if a writer needs further guidance about the use of euphemisms, let it be noted that it tends to be the less educated who are most addicted to these linguistic evasions. These are the people who refer to every man as a gentleman, as did the reporter who referred to the Norwegian gentleman who killed 77 people. Optimistically, however, Bernstein believes that such genteelisms are passing. Even so, the process of expurgation and euphemism flourishes in ever more creative ways. For example, au naturel is a phrase that covers up nudity, so to speak. Prisons are now known as corrective facilities, and politicians, denied the right to call their fellows liars, may say only that they are guilty of being economical with the truth. Similarly, British newspapers are not allowed to describe a politician in that country as drunk, but only as appearing tired and emotional. Thus, the former British Foreign Secretary George Brown, who was a perpetual drunk and would be regularly falling out of taxis and going splosh into the sidewalk, was described as being tired and emotional. Oh well, euphemism has clearly not passed away, but what the heck?
Dr. David Woods is a Philadelphia-based medical writer and editor. You can read his commentary and those by others in our region at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Tomorrow evening, we'll speak to a widow about her battles with the Department of Veteran Affairs over her husband's medical claims. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.